Session number 12938.
Mr. Dunreal 2, were there any incidents that happened to you whilst you were at Fort Goma that you can recount, please?
Well, there's two incidents that happened. We were lying asleep one night, and when the Germans came over and bombing around the area, because we had the tanks on the outside of the field just under the trees, and they started bombing, our guns were open fire on it, on the Germans. And the shrapnel came down, and we were lying under the tarpaulins of the tank, and the shrapnel came straight through, and there was two of us lying on our legs like that, and went straight between our legs. Two of us that happened, and we were very, very keen to get out of the, from underneath the tarpaulins after that. The other thing that happened, it wasn't to me especially, but it happened in the camp, was we'd been into this area for a month. And the Winnipeg Rifles, they liked a good drink. And of course, the night before we were going to sail, the Naffy ran out of beer. And of course, the Winnipeg Rifles wasn't very happy about it. So they went in and smashed the Naffy up and poured everything in the middle and set fire to the lot, which wasn't very far from an ammunition dump. And of course, that caused quite a bit of a havoc, because they had to get the fire engines running around, and they were trying to get the ammunition and everything out of the ammunition dump, just in case. It caused quite a bit of excitement.
They sound as though they were a rather wild bunch.
The Winnipegs were. And I said, I think they were half Apache. They all had the Mohican haircuts, you know, just straight across here. And they carried the knives, and they liked the knives better than the guns.
You mean commando knives?
No, they had their own knives. It wasn't commando knives. They had a bit bigger knife, and something similar to the Bowie knife.
Now, can you take me through the actual 5th of June in detail, as far as it affected you, the day when it was supposed to take place, but it was cancelled?
Well, on the 4th of June, which was the original date for landing on the 5th, we were in Southampton Waters, just off Leon Solent, and the order was given for the landing craft to move, and we all moved off. There's quite a few moved off to go down the Isle of Wight, past the Isle of Wight, to go off for the get the flotilla together, and we were all just sitting on the landing craft, and we were told by the skipper to keep an eye open for aircraft recognition and see if there's any aircraft coming in across, and that's what we were supposed to be doing all the way across. I think was the idea, was to keep our minds off what we were going to do, was to keep aircraft spotting and watch for a different aircraft. And the sea was starting to get a bit rough as we go down that way, and could see the waves coming, mighty waves coming along. And then we got the order to turn back, and we came back to where we were originally, and we stayed there overnight. And then we got the order again for D-Day later on.
How did you feel about the postponement?
Well, we weren't very happy about it, because we thought it was going to be not just for a night, we thought it was going to be for quite a long time. We thought, well, if we don't go now, which we'd been told in our training, if we didn't go at that particular period of time, the tides and things wouldn't suit at a later date, until quite a bit later. You know, couldn't be put off just for a day or two, it had to be put off for a long time. But fortunately, or unfortunately for some, that they decided that June the 6th would be the actual D-Day, and so we had to leave on the 5th from Leon Solent. And we came down then, we came down the river then as joint forces with the rest of the landing craft, and we had destroyers, corvettes and other different ships coming alongside of us to escort us down to join the big convoy. And there were some smaller landing craft, were about a dozen or so many, and going alongside as well. And the main order we got as we were sailing, and this came over the loudspeaker before we got into the sea itself, was you don't stop for anything. If any ship falls foul, you don't stop to pick them up. If anybody falls over the board or anything like that, you don't stop to pick them up. Which some of these little landing craft did overturn as we were going. And our skipper was pretty good. He slowed down to try and pick some of the lads up. And then this MTB came along and they weren't very happy with us and told us we had to get back into line and leave them. Those other MTBs would come along and pick these lads up to make sure that the timing was exact. I think this was the idea of it. That the timing had to be exact for everybody. And I tell you, it was one of the most marvellous sights you could ever wish to see that convoy, when they were all out, when they all got out to sea. And the landing craft and the naval ships that was escorting us. I've never seen a sight like it, except when we landed after I got wounded. I think that was the best sight I've saw after that. Marvellous. But to see that convoy forming and how pieces interlocked, it let you see, it give you a good idea of the people behind, how they worked it out. It must have been a terrific job for all people concerned to get the coordination, to make sure that everything linked in with each, for the timing of it was so good.
Were you sitting in your aviary as you went across?
No. No, we were told our best bet was to keep out of the aviary and walk about or do aircraft spotting. We were up on the bridge most of the time doing aircraft spotting, because we saw during the night we saw our planes going across with the airborne people. We saw them going across because they were flying pretty low. And being in June, it wasn't too dark. It was like a twilight, and you saw the planes all going across. About halfway across, I decided I wanted to go to the toilet, fortunately. And of course, the toilet's right up in the front of the landing craft. And of course, when you got there and the ship was going up and down like that, I was seasick for the best part of a good halfway across. And I just got out nicely, and we were told to mount the tank sticks to go to do the landing. As soon as we were told that, I was all right. I'd been seasick for quite a while, but as soon as we were told to mount up, and I think everything just left me, and I was all right. I could sit in the tank, no problem. From there, it was just seeing everything after that, like, you know, different things we saw. But when we sailed past the HMS Roberts and she opened up, I thought she'd hit our ship, actually. But I think they used the HMS Roberts later on as one of the barriers, I think, on the when they did the bridge and they did the dock up at Aramonsh. I think that's where they put her down there. I'm not sure.
What was the atmosphere in the tank like as you went in?
Well, all we had time for, really, you know, we got orders to mount, and then the landing craft stopped. Drop the ramps for us to come down, and everybody straight away we all shouted good luck to each other. And the first tank off the landing craft was a flail tank, and one of these Canadian tanks came off in front of us on the flail, and I was following him. I had to follow him off, and we came through these narrow gap that the done for us. These people that had been lying overnight, they'd made these gaps in the defence for us to get through. And then you had to drive onto the beach. And when the atmosphere in the tank then was a little bit tense, because you battened down and I was the only man that could see. My little visor that I had in front of me to watch, see where I was going, and I was the only man that could see, because the tank commander, they were all the button down more or less, because the shells and the ammunition was bullets was coming across the top of us. And my co-director, Bill Hortons, was sitting behind me, and he was keep asking me what was going on, could he see, you know. And my main concern when I got off that morning was, as we came up on the beach, seeing all the lads that had gone in, the infantry, being shot down and lying on the beach. And I was a bit concerned in case I hit any of them when you were driving along, because you only had a narrow breeze to look through, and you were driving along the beach, you know, and there was, you didn't know whether they were dead or whether they were alive or what, you know, these people that were lying there, whether they just ducked down out of ammunition, out of the way of bullets flying around, or whether they were dead. But in any case, you had to pick your way through so you didn't catch any of them. And I think that's what worried me more than anything at that morning as we drove along through the beach. And we were telling the lads, because you saw some of them bodies was passing up with some of this defences they had along the beach, being shot as they were trying to come through, you know. But once I got off the beach and followed the route that I had to do, my mind straight away went to the job we had to do. And of course, we drove up the beach, following this flail, and the mines was going off as he was hitting them with the flail. But the trouble with the flail, it's all right going along level ground. But as soon as you start to go like that, it misses.
That's going uphill.
Yeah. The misses just on the hollow of the hill, that little bit. And the Germans must have had an idea about this. And they placed one there and it knocked his tracks off. So I had to push him to more or less to one side to carry on to where I had to go. And when I got to where we had to drop the vaccine, we couldn't see it, couldn't see the culvert at all. But in my mind, that's where we should be. So I said to our sergeant, to my tank commander, I said, Jim, that can't see the culvert. So he radioed back to Captain Hewitt, who was on the beach, and the orders we got were carry on. And I knew the culvert should be there. So I put the tank in first gear, and as soon as it would start to move, it went straight down, because the Germans had flooded the area, and you couldn't see the culvert, you see. And as soon as I put the tank in the first gear, it just straight down. Truck snapped, the water started coming in the turret. And of course, for me being right at the front, I was the last one out. And everybody had to get out a bit sharpies, because the bullets were flying all over the place. And I was last man out, and I started to swallow water, actually, because it was all coming in the turret. And I was last one out, and as my tank co-driver got out, he put his knees in both sides of my head, my temple, and as he came out, he dragged me with him. And of course, I started to put quite a bit of water in my stomach by then, and Bill Hawkins was standing just outside of the turret waiting for me coming out to drag me out. And when we got out, he just hit me once in the stomach to get rid of the... He hadn't time for any niceties or anything like that. It just brought the water up, and that was it. Of course, the bullets were still hitting the turret, and so we decided our best bet, which was the nearest, was the seaward side of the culvert. We had to jump off the tank to get back to that side of it, which is, I think the jump would probably be about 5 or 6 feet. We had to get back onto that side. And by the time we got back on that side, Captain Hewitt's tank, he'd come up then to see what was happening. And he put his tank between us and the Germans and drove and brought us back into the sand dunes. And he went away and left us then. And we just lay down behind the sand dunes. And Jim Ashton started to sing Kiss Me Again, because like a father figure, I mean, he's a good lad, and he always did this, tried to settle us all down, because I was the youngest one in the tank crew. But he always did something like this. He'd always sing or something, just trying to settle you. And he just started to sing when the mortar bombs came and dropped between us. And I'd killed four outright. If I'd killed three outright, definitely. I was wounded, Bill Horton was badly wounded. The co-driver he rolled over to me, and he had a hole in his back that I put my fist in, and he said, I'll crawl for help. And he crawled away. And I was told afterwards, I just saw him roll over after he got about 100 yards from us. And I was told that's where he died. But I rolled down into a minefield. In fact, when I looked up, there's a big board, Acton Minen, straight above my head. And I thought, God, blimey. So I managed to get onto my feet. And I ran about 50 yards, which the doctors said it was impossible when I got home, because I had 5 compound fractures in one of my legs. And then I said, well, when you're frightened and there's bullets flying around, it makes you do queer things. But I collapsed. My legs just gave away from me and I just collapsed. I didn't know how badly I was wounded then. Then I was two lads come and dragged me back. And I told them that Bill Hawkins was still up there. And asked me about the others. I said, well, I'm pretty sure that the others are dead. And went up to Bill Horton's and brother took me back to further back and lay me beside another sand dune and give me a cigarette and a drink. And left me there. I was left there for quite a while. And the first one came on the scene after that was a Canadian medical officer. And he gave me an injection of morphine and put a card around my neck to say, give me morphine, you know. And then they took off. Then there was two Canadians came to me. I must have been lying with my eyes shut, because the two Canadians came and they started to go through my pockets. And they took my watch out of his pocket and my whistle, and I had a commando knife stitched to my trousers leg, and they took that. And then I opened my eyes and one of them turned around and says, you better leave this bugger, he's alive. And they took off. And then my own unit came back after that, two of the lads from my own unit. And they carried me back to further back towards the beach. And then they brought Bill Hawkins down alongside me. And they laid the two stretchers right between two priest guns. And both of them opened up together. And they just lifted the stretchers of bubble bangs down. And I was lying there. The worst experience of the time that I had then was that there was an armoured bulldozer was about 50 feet from us when we were lying on the stretchers there, and we could see him. And the armoured bulldozer comes up the sides like that round the driver, the armour, and the shell had hit the armour plating just there. It must have been hit twice, because the one had hit the engine, one hit where the driver was sitting, and it just jammed him in. He wasn't wounded, just jammed him in. But he couldn't get out, and the armoured bulldozer was on fire, and nobody could get near it. And that was my worst experience, because you heard this man screaming, and there's nobody could do a damn thing for him. It was unfortunate. And, from there, we were taken back onto the beach. By this time, it was getting pretty well late in the afternoon. Taken at the beach, and we were laid in lines right along the beach, all the wounded. You had your medical officers coming around, and they were saying, well, Blighty or whichever, you know, you this one to stay here, the other one goes. And they said Bill Hortons and I had was Blighty. And then all of a sudden, these fighter bombers came along, the German fighter bombers came along the beach, bombing, dropping bombs along the beach. And it seemed as though they dropped in between landing craft. And then I turned over, I just looked to my right, which was along towards Wistrom, which I didn't know then, mind, but that along towards Wistrom. I saw our Spitfires come along, and they sorted them out, they shot them down. There was one engine dropped about 30 or 40 feet from us. From there, Bill and I was put onto a duck. I think there was 6 or 8 stretches, putting some in the bottom and then some on the top to be taken out. And so I think it was about 7 o'clock at night to be put onto this American hospital ship. And we only got, I think, about 30 or 40 feet, yards away from the beach when the thing got hit, the duck. And it got put out of action. So they had to pull us back, tow us back with another one, and get us all back onto the beach, and then put us onto another duck to take us out to the hospital ship. They took us out to the hospital ship, and that's when I lost, for the first time of the day, that's when I lost consciousness. And I didn't come to again until we got into Southampton. And as we got into Southampton, they just brought us off the hospital ship, and they were just putting us into the ambulance when I came to, and Bill Hawkins came, the carried him and put us both in the same ambulance. Because Bill spoke to me, and then we went into this, forgetting what they call the hospital now. It's been knocked down now in Southampton. It took us there. And I don't know what happened once I got into the hospital, because I went unconscious there. But apparently they stripped me off. And I saw X-ray. I saw them bring an X-ray machine to me in bed. And that was the last I knew for about 3 or 4 days. And it's set for my family to come down, to come and see me. Apparently I was only given overnight to live. And this, for about 4 nights, I took the kept telling everybody that that's all I could go, you know. Because by then, my arm had been hanging off, apparently. It was only on by a thread.
This is your left arm?
Yeah. And both my legs were supposed to come off. They took my arm off. It was only on a thread. The parts of my legs, both my legs was plastered right up to the hips. And apparently both my legs were shattered and spinal injuries. And I couldn't do much with this arm. This arm was paralysed for a while.
That's your right arm?
Uh-huh. And then when my family came to see us, and I finally came round, my mother and brother came to see me, actually. And I managed to say, I told them that my arm was off. And they wanted to know how I knew. And it was strange, one of the nurses was making the bed, and they turned the bedclothes right back, and I saw it. And I wasn't supposed to say it, apparently. And they asked my mother if she would tell us my arm was off the hospital people. And I told her, before, you know, straight away. But the first thing I wanted to know was how Bill Hawkins was. Now, I asked my parents, my mother, like, because my father had been killed earlier. I asked my mother if she would find Bill Hawkins for me, because I knew he'd gone into that hospital. Now, she was told that Bill had died. Now, Bill's wife and family, they had asked where I was, and they were told I died. And this went on for 12 years. I tried always to find Bill, and he tried always to find me. And eventually we found each other, but it was 12 years after the war. Mine was a big, good reunion when we met each other afterwards. Like.
So, the extent of your injuries were to your legs, to your left arm and your spine?
Yeah.
And today, 1992, to what extent have you managed to recover from the wounds?
Well, I don't think I've ever recovered, really. To a degree, I've had 32 operations, removing shrapnel, bones and things like this. And this year, I've just had one on the spine. It was a more serious operation than what we'd anticipated when they got me into the hospital. And it's all concerning the spine. I've got to cut some of the discs and fuse some of the bones and move muscles and nerves and God knows around. I don't know actually what everything they've done. They've only told me a bit about what's been done. They just told me it was a big operation that they'd anticipated. It was a 4.5 hour operation.
But you are able to function, really, because you can drive a car and...
I've never been beat, I don't think. I've never tried. I've tried to overcome my disability ever since I first came home. I've drove thousands and thousands of miles in the car, been all over the country driving the car. I do a lot of work for BLESMA, war pensions and things like this, so I try to keep going.
Is there anything that you can't do?
Well, there's a few things I can't do that I've got to get my wife to help me, you know. Certain things, we're only having the one arm to fasten me the buttons on different things on the right arm and this type of thing.
And people talk nowadays about the psychological effects of having been in wars. We hear a lot about why aren't people counselled and this type of thing. What do you think about all that?
Well, I think the best counselling they get is the one families. Yeah, because the one families can do a lot to help the person. I know they did for me. My wife's done a hell of a lot for me. We were never counselled, and I think that nobody had more stress than anybody that went in and any action during the war, not just D-Day. And I've never known of anybody being counselled in the war. And it was first time I heard about it was when about the Falklands and things like that. Now I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Because, I say, when you're in hospital, the doctors talk to you, the nurses talk to you. And as they said, your own family does more for you than anybody else can, which I quite agree with them. Because they guide you to where you want to, where they want you to go, and the way you want to go, really. And, I was just told, get on with it. You've lost your arm, you've got disabilities. And I think I fought to overcome it with the help of my wife and the family. And I think it's been better for me, that, yeah.
But was there any psychological stress for having been in combat?
Well, I think there was, because for years afterwards, I used to get these dreams, and I could go back, and I still can, and every minute of what happened on D-Day and before, you know, seems to come back at times, and seeing this lad in this bulldozer, seeing my own crew shot down beside me, and as I've said before to other people, those crew, my crew members, were closer to me then than what my family were. Because we all had a job to do. We all depended on each other. We all knew that if one made a mistake, it could cost the lives of the others. So therefore, you had to be very, very careful of what you did and made sure you did the job properly. So this is why when you work together. You see, in a tank crew, which when I was in the Armoured Corps and the CM in the Royal Engineers, in a tank crew, you work together, you have to sleep together more or less under the canvas sheets off the tank. You went out together. If you wanted a drink, you went and had a drink together. That you weren't parted. So you knew the actions of the other crew members. You could more or less read them before they did them. You were so used to them. And you knew that if you went, when you go into action, you knew that they were going to fight for you as well as you were going to fight for them. And you work pretty, very close together.
These nightmares, is it always the same nightmare?
More or less, yeah. And it's a bit frightening at times.
What happens in the nightmare?
Well, it goes back, you go back to the actual thing, you know, where you were lying, where you got hit. It goes from when you were wounded, and you